Welcome to Hero Hype, episode 27. Yep, that's right, 27. Basically, we are back on track. We are right on schedule again. So, we're going to be, obviously, the last episode that's gone up had the Supergirl pilot in, and there is no other Supergirl episodes. So we'll be recapping everything else that was on TV this week. And, yeah, giving you another comic corner. So you've got two of those this week. Lucky, lucky guys. As always, guys, if you want to get hold of us and get involved in the conversation, you can do so via our Twitter account, which is at Hero Hype Podcast. You can leave us a comment on this post when it goes up on hypeable.com, or you can send us an email, which is herohypepodcast@gmail.com. As always, I'm Danya, I'm back, and I'm joined once again by Caitlin.
Hello.
Yeah. And yeah, this one will probably be a shorter episode because we covered a lot of the early news in this that came out this week in episode 26. So yeah, there hasn't been a lot since we recorded that episode on... When did we record it? We recorded it Monday, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, it's mostly going to be us talking about TV shows and... lucky us, because at least one of them has a lot for us to talk about.
It's true.
It's very, very true. So, we'll get things started with a brief history. And who do we have for you this week? Oh, we have Mr. Terrific. So, Michael Holt was a gifted child and would eventually become the third smartest man in the world. Showing an aptitude for most subjects, he displayed remarkable intelligence and was studying advanced science where most other children were watching Sesame Street. Michael grew up with his older, mentally handicapped brother Jeffrey, who died when Michael was 15, leaving him devastated. Michael went on to possess 14 PhDs across various subjects, including engineering and physics, and became a self-made millionaire through his high-tech firm Cyberware, which was eventually sold to Wayne Tech. Aside from this, Michael Holt was also an Olympic gold medal decathlete. After the loss of his wife and unborn child in an accident, Michael contemplated suicide. During his darkest hour, he was visited by the Spectre, who told him about Terry Sloan, the first incarnation of Mr. Terrific. Inspired by Sloan's life story, Michael adopted the name and became a superhero. Though he had no powers of his own, he used his T-spheres, which floated around him. The T-spheres can perform amazing technological feats, including holographic projection, providing live camera feeds, expelling electric charges, and carrying Michael's weight, allowing him to fly. Michael eventually joined the Justice Society of America, and later became its chairman, setting him up as a counterpart to Batman, with whom he has a friendly rivalry. Yeah, so why are we telling you about Mr. Terrific? Well, we figured you could use a little bit more background in him, seeing as he's featuring a lot more heavily in Arrow at the moment.
So you'll notice his name is not Michael Holt, it's Curtis Holt.
Yeah, which, you know, I guess they like making, like, little changes and moving things around and throwing you off guard with a lot of things on that show. So, yeah, we don't know if they're going to go with a lot of those origins and things that have happened to him. I mean, it's probably unlikely we're going to see the Spectre, seeing as he was already on Constantine. But I guess if we're having Constantine on, we may go down that route. But who knows at this point? What do you think? Do you think that they're going to involve anything else from his, like, backstory from the comics?
Well, we know that his brother died.
Mm.
But all we know is that he had cancer. So, and we know that he is gay in this version, so he's not going to lose a wife and an unborn child.
No.
He could technically lose his husband, but he already is showing, like, heroic aspirations. He's kind of reminding me of Ray, and that he's coming in as like, I want to make the city a better place. So, and he's using his, we already saw he's engineering the T-spheres, so I imagine they're just gonna go and make him kind of a tech-based hero as well.
Which is interesting in respect to, I guess, Felicity, when we're first introduced to Felicity, because they've already set them up as kind of parallel characters. Like, their personalities are very, very similar, and they both have a very solid tech background. They're both very, very good at very technical things. So it's going to be interesting to see the different paths you can take in regard to, I guess, becoming a full-blown superhero without actually having any kind of powers and just being, you know, technologically advanced. Like, that's going to be quite interesting to see, I guess, that parallel, like, how Felicity helps the team versus how Mr. Terrific is going to play out.
And we don't know how long he'll stick around, because they brought in Ray and then he's off to Legends of Tomorrow, so they may introduce Curtis and give him his powers and then ship him off to Legends of Tomorrow season 2. So who knows? Or whatever their new spinoff is going to be, because they seem to be doing a spinoff a year.
Yeah. I kind of hope he'll stay on Arrow, though. I really do.
Too, but yeah. I'm getting a little cynical about it.
I know. Well, I mean, by the time we got to the end of Arrow season 3, Ray was starting to grow on me a little bit more. Like, I was kind of enjoying his character here and there. And, you know, I kind of went through waves of, like, really liking him and sometimes getting annoyed by him. But I think it was mostly because I felt like a lot of the time he didn't have a character of his own. He was there to kind of further Felicity's plot, and sometimes it went the other way around. Like, it just frustrated me a little bit how they used those two characters with each other last season. You know, it bothers me when you use a woman to further a man's plot in a storyline, but I also get annoyed when you try and do it the other way around, because, you know, I'm more invested and more interested in characters when they have their own storylines outside of furthering themselves through, like, an often almost convoluted romance plot for the sake of it, and for the sake of causing a bit of drama and tension for your main character. So, I don't know. I kind of hope he sticks around, because I'm looking forward to seeing Ray now in a show where he's set apart from a romantic plotline, and to see if he kind of blossoms as a character a little bit more there. But because they've brought Curtis in without having that expectation and without having that there, like, I'm enjoying him as an individual character and seeing him playing off everyone, because they're not using him the way that they used Ray. I don't know if I'm alone in thinking that or not.
I never had a problem with Ray. I adored him, and I am happy to see him again. So I think I'm in the minority for having loved him, but I thought he was wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I like I said, I had glimmers of moments where I was like, yes, do more of that. And then they'd go back to just playing up the romance angle without, like, giving anything more, like, any more motivations outside of that. So it just rubbed me up the wrong way sometimes. And I think why it rubbed me up the wrong way is I thought they could be doing so much more with the character, because I'd start to get moments where I was like, yes, yes, this is what I want. And then it would be like they drop the ball. But then I felt that way through a lot of season 3 in general. So
I was going to say that was kind of the theme of season 3, is there were glimmers of really cool, really awesome things. And then it was like, and you're not going there. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I'm loving the direction that they're going in this season. So, yeah, I just, yeah. I guess the bottom line is, I hope Curtis sticks around after all that. That's basically what I'm getting at. But as for actual news on the TV side of things, we have two headlines, essentially, for you. The first one is that we got a Jessica Jones poster, which gives a really great look at David Tennant as Kilgrave, who is going to be the main villain through the entire series. And what's really cool about this poster, and they did a similar one for Jessica as well, is that this kind of purple painterly kind of look that it's got to it, it's actually based off one of the original comic book covers from the Alias series. So if you go and look it up online, if you just type in like Jessica Jones Alias cover, you'll find one that has the same kind of purple painting, kind of almost watercolor-esque look to it. And I really love that they're giving that throwback to the original comics. What did you think of this poster? Because it only came out today.
I liked it. I didn't have much more to think beyond that. Just, I'm ready for Jessica Jones to be in my life.
Yeah, it's not long now. It'll be here before we know it. Have you got a countdown on your phone? Because I've kind of got a countdown on my phone.
I cannot say that I do.
I'm kind of alone in that then.
Oh, well.
Yeah. What can I say? My obsession, it knows no bounds.
Yeah, that, speaking of themes of hero hype.
Yeah.
All right, so our one other piece of TV news is Supergirl related, because it premiered this week and we got the premiere ratings and it did really well. It got 12.96 million viewers, which is a 3.1 share in the demographic. What does that mean? Essentially, it tied with Blindspot for the fall's highest rated series premiere, so super good. And it's tied for the fourth highest rated series premiere of the entire year. So doing really well. It had really strong numbers for its first episode. So CBS is the highest rated network on television. So you expect bigger numbers than you would get on the CW, but those are still very good numbers. So the test will come when it's airing on its own at 8 o'clock without the Big Bang Theory in front of it. So we'll see how many people hang around having seeing the pilot and liking it.
Yeah, I actually saw a really interesting article today on Salon. It was written by actually a male writer who essentially was saying, you know, Supergirl isn't for me, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And he kind of dissected a lot of the criticism that people were giving it, and also his own internalized criticism when he saw the original teaser, like, months and months and months ago, and basically saying, you know, it's kind of this internalized version of how he looks at female characters and how he treats female characters, and I guess he was saying, like, women in general, because when it comes down to it, what he loves about characters like Superman is that it's ridiculous fun and escapism, and Clark being an inherently good person who you can really enjoy without, like, it needing to be anything more than him having, like, a mundane, almost mundane life in his day-to-day with ridiculous, heroic things going on around him, and saying, like, he loves Clark Kent, he loves the Superman stuff, but he hated the idea of Supergirl. And he basically turned around and said, it's because we don't see a lot of stuff like that for women, this pure escapism where it's like almost wish fulfillment watching, because you juxtapose her having an ordinary life with extraordinary things going on around her. And he said, it's ridiculous when we love stuff like, or male viewers can enjoy stuff like Guardians of the Galaxy and Ant-Man and stuff like that, and really enjoy the kind of narrative that goes along with that, when those main characters are essentially, you know, mundane people. You know, it's kind of like you look at Ant-Man as being the narrative of a single father trying to do the best for his daughter while extraordinary things happen around him, that sort of thing. And he was like, when you flip it around and it becomes a woman, you know, people lash out at it as being, like, childish and ridiculous and so on. But he said, why can't women have what we have in things like Guardians of the Galaxy and Ant-Man and Superman. He was like, it may not be for us, but it is for so many other people, and we need to stop putting it down. And I just, it's an amazing read. If you can go and just find the article, it was making the rounds on Twitter. It was really nice to see someone dissect what's making people lash out a little bit. And he was one of them. He was like, he had to take a hard look at himself and why he was reacting the way he was reacting. And it was just a really interesting read. All told, I kind of caught it on my lunch break earlier today. So, did you see that going around earlier?
I did not, but that sounds great.
Yeah, it was a really good read. It's super long. It's really, really long. It took me a good 10-15 minutes to get through start to finish. Like, it was a long article, but, you know, he hit on a lot of things that probably, like, it's what kind of made such a personal reaction from so many people, because I think the timing was so bad with that teaser coming out, with it coming out around the same time that Black Widow Saturday Night Live sketch trailer came out. And he touches on that a little bit as well by going, you know, those are completely different in that Supergirl is a character who is very happy, very joyous, very, you know, bubbly, effervescent, you know, she is a completely different character to Black Widow. So whereas that trailer full of joy, full of almost romance, almost escapism, works for a character like Kara because it's inspiring for hundreds of thousands of women. Whereas when you juxtapose that with a character like Black Widow, and she's set up as an assassin with a very dark and traumatic past, that's why that doesn't work for a character like Black Widow, and it's a parody, and why it kind of, when you look at it, it's almost becomes a joke, because it's the specific character that it doesn't work for, not the fact that that narrative, there's anything wrong with that narrative. Like, you can be a successful career woman or have, you know, career goals, and still have these fantastical things happening around you which push you to be your best person and kind of, yeah, it just, the actual reading of that article was, like, fantastic. Go find it. In fact, I will go back, grab the link, and I'm going to put it in the show notes so you can all can read it, because it just, yeah, it was great.
If only more people could be so self-reflective.
Yeah.
Alas.
I know.
This one other thing with Supergirl was that after the episode aired, we got a kind of 2-minute trailer of what we can expect in other episodes, and it was all kinds of awesome. You've got Kara dealing with her job and dealing with Cat Grant, who wants to write an article and interview Supergirl, and you've got her running into her aunt, who we saw at the very end of the pilot. And that was a big surprise. Mostly all kinds of awesome things. There's a moment where she and Jimmy or James are sharing a little romantic moment. We also see Lucy Lane and just all kinds of awesome highlights.
Also laser eyes.
Yes, laser eyes.
Seriously. Though the brief flash that we got, I was kind of like, I don't think they finished the CG on that. Totally, or the CGI on that totally, because it looked a little unfinished, but I was like, oh cool, laser eyes, yay. Yeah, just everything in this trailer was absolutely fantastic, and it's got me even more hyped up for the rest of this season. And I really, really like the little moment where James is like, I just want... It was James, wasn't it? Where he's like, I just want to keep you safe. And then she kind of goes, the S stands for a lot of things, but safe isn't one of them. And I was just like, that was just an amazing line.
I just need it all. I need it all.
Well, Monday, we get a new episode on Monday. Or, well, you guys get a new episode on Monday. I get to find a way to watch it on Tuesday.
So yeah, that was Supergirl. And
yes,
we
it
will
was.
be recapping the next episode in our next week episode.
Yeah. But speaking of recapping episodes.
I see what you did there.
Oh ho! Okay, so what version of Heartbreak do we want to start with? That's the question.
Should we start with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Oh god. Yeah. I guess this episode's going to be quite easy to talk about because it all happened in essentially one place. And it's... I will say of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. with this episode, it was incredibly brave for them to essentially do, like, a bottle episode where it just all happens in one enclosed space and focuses specifically on one character. Like... And not even, like, one of the ones that they kind of give main billing in, like, all of, like, their promo and stuff. Because, you know, for the most part, you could say that Coulson and Daisy are the two, you know, leads in this show. But to kind of strip it back to focus specifically on one character, like, I just thought it was amazingly done. Because you've got to rely on that character to basically, and that actor, to carry the entire episode from start to finish. And sure, Gemma wasn't alone, but it still relied very heavily on her to kind of carry the entire episode on her own. Did you think that it was successful for you?
Oh yeah, I thought this episode was incredible. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but I think they did an amazing job, and the actress really succeeded in having to put the episode on her shoulders and really deal with something that we don't see Simmons dealing with, like that kind of stress and survival. She's always been in the lab, so seeing her have to go survival mode and seeing her success is just very satisfying.
Yeah, it really, really was. 'Cause, you know, of all the characters that you would expect in a very harsh survival situation to make it through, I don't think a lot of people would have assumed that Gemma would have been one of the ones who would have been able to survive, you know, what we know of her and Fitz, and especially their time in the academy. It's all been very, you know, theory-based or practically based in terms of their scientific abilities. But, you know, being able to see her when, you know, it comes down to sheer survival instincts, her being able to use her unique outlook and her intelligence to keep herself alive, you know, that I was just awed through the whole episode. Like, I could not look away.
Yeah, massive props. And she really had to deal with some insane things. And in the part where she has just gotten there and has been there for a couple days and realizes that there's the sun's not coming, like, and she just screams, like, I want the sun! I was just like, my heart broke. I was like, this episode is gonna destroy me.
Yeah, and it did. But, you know, she does find out eventually that she's not completely alone. And, you know, this relationship that she has kind of divided people quite heavily. Like, I've seen a lot of mixed reactions to how that all played out, you know, both positive and negative. I've seen some people go really off the rails with kind of what this does to Fitz. And... yeah, that was basically my reaction. I was kind of like, but the whole point is that this wasn't about Fitz. You know, you kind of, boiling it down, this was a story of sheer survival. And as far as either of them were aware, there was no way either of them are getting back to where they came from. Like, that's it. They're stranded, they're alone, they only have each other. And, you know, when you're put into that kind of extreme situation, it also leads to some very extreme emotions. She can still care for Fitz, but, you know, there was a very, very high chance that she would never see Fitz again. So taking comfort in the only other person that you could potentially ever see again, Like, that's completely understandable. And the thing is that, you know, she didn't forget about Fitz. Fitz was still there. Fitz still drove her to carry on. And it's not, even when she gets back, it's not about him. And I think when you finally get to him at the end of the episode, even though he's very kind of, you can tell he's taken aback and he's a little bit emotional and so on about it, but he also realizes this isn't about him as well. And he realizes that what he needs to do is what's best for Simmons. And if that means putting his own romantic feelings aside in order to, you know, save the person who helped her through something that was incredibly traumatic when he physically couldn't be there. Like, we should all be taking a leaf out of Fitz's book and realizing this was a story that was solely about Gemma, her survival and her trauma. You know, this isn't about ships. It's not. Exactly. We may feel very strongly about these relationships, but when it boils down to it, when you're put into that kind of extreme survival situation, your life, your outlook on life changes. You know, there is no going back sometimes from that kind of trauma. And we saw it a lot with the trauma that Fitz faced himself last season and how that changed him as a character and, you know, how his and Simmons' relationship changed and, you know, the people who helped him through his trauma. You know, I don't know. I just got really frustrated seeing people trying to turn around a story that was all about Gemma's survival and trying to make it about Fitz and Fitz's heartbreak when even Fitz as a character wasn't making it about himself.
Yeah, exactly. I was honestly surprised it took as long as it did for them to get a physical connection, just because it was two people with literally the only people on the planet, probably, and both heavily traumatized, probably thinking they'll never get to see each other or see home again, and only having each other and needing to depend on each other to continue to survive. And if you can find a little bit of pleasure in each other, there's nothing wrong with that because it's going to keep you going. So I was honestly surprised it took as long into the episode as it did to get there, but I wasn't surprised at all.
No, me either. And I think they were both, for what they were going through at that particular time, they were, like, the relationship was good for both of them at that particular point. And the thing is that you can still really care for someone and the potential of what could have been and still hold some regard and hope and fondness for that, but also be in love with someone else at the same time. You know, that's kind of the frailty of human relationships. You can sometimes care for someone very deeply and then through a set of circumstances fall for someone else a little harder. You know, it's what happens. It's human emotion. It's life. You know, this is why relationships and stuff break down, you know? It is what it is.
And that's not to say that those two won't end up together at some point. It just means during these horrific circumstances, Gemma found Ben and they were good for each other in that situation. They may rescue him and get back to Earth and find they don't work together at all.
Yeah.
But it's just the circumstances that they were in is what put them together. And I don't think anyone should take that away from her because it was totally, totally made sense to me.
Yeah, completely made sense to me as well. And I just, this whole episode was just a masterclass in storytelling and character-driven episodes. Like, they were so brave to do what they did by, like, taking it away from the ensemble show and really, like, delving deep into what is essentially the psychology of humanity and how we act and react in very extreme conditions. And I'm still completely blown away by this episode. Like, it's just, it was beautifully done. And the thing, if this doesn't go up for Emmys and doesn't win something, I will be shocked. I will be seriously shocked.
why it's genre TV. Genre TV doesn't win anything.
Yeah, but the thing is that it, even for what is a genre show that gets snubbed for ridiculously elitist reasons, it was beautiful storytelling and it was fantastic TV. Like, it was absolutely stunning. From the opening seconds to the dying seconds, I was just... I don't think I've seen an episode that good on TV this year. Like, it's probably, like, the height of amazing storytelling for this year, full stop. And I've watched a hell of a lot of TV this year. For me, anyway.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but it was pretty damn good.
I just thought it was amazing. Like, I thought it was really, really great. But what do we want to move on to next?
Shall we move to The Flash?
Yeah, let's move to The Flash.
So, The Flash 204, The Fury of Firestorm, we pick up with the team trying to help Dr. Stein because... for science-y mumbo-jumbo reasons, his condition is worsening because he doesn't have Ronnie to fuse with anymore. So Caitlin has drawn up a couple of potential matches that could be the other part of Firestorm, and they test and both could work. So one is a scientist and named Henry Hewitt, and the other is a mechanic named Jefferson Jackson, a.k.a. Jax. And they go meet both of them, and they bring the scientist to the lab, and he and Stein kind of hit it off, but the fusion doesn't work. Sorry. And he's not happy about it, because he's a real peach of a human being, as the episode goes on. But apparently, the attempt to fuse with him activated his latent metahuman powers, which will become a problem later.
Understatement.
But so they are left with Jax, who at first doesn't want anything to do with the whole thing, because when the particle accelerator exploded, he was injured and it ended his football playing career, which was his chance to go to college. His family couldn't afford it otherwise. So he's really bitter about it. But he ends up turning it down the first time. And Caitlin is not happy about it. And she really snaps at him. So I was kind of wondering what we thought about Caitlin in this episode, because she was having a bit of a hard time.
And I mean, understandably so. If you think about the reason why Dr. Stein is having these difficulties in the first place and the kind of really difficult memories it drags up for her, because obviously the person that she loved was the other half of this duo, and it just kind of throws back into the forefront that it's his being gone, dead, that is causing all of this. And it's going to be a very difficult emotional situation for her to have to deal with, knowing that his death is what is now potentially causing the complete breakdown and potential death of the other half of Firestorm. And, you know, feeling that responsibility, that weight of another life on her shoulders, I didn't necessarily think it was out of character for her to get as emotionally charged as she did and to lash out the way that she did.
Yeah, and additionally, she was essentially doing all this work to search for the replacement for her late husband, and that sort of has to make it feel like there's a sense of finality to his death, because it was sort of open-ended until they found a replacement, and this sort of shuts the door completely. Like, we see at the end, she changes his file to Jack's file, and there's a moment where she hesitates about it. So it's like completely closing the book on Ronnie, and that's got to be really hard, especially since she already lost him once and then is having to shut the door on that a second time.
Yeah, I guess it's almost like burying him. Like, it's that finality. It's that after this point, there is no coming back. That's it. This is the new Firestorm, and it's never going to go back to the way that it was. And she's lost him for good this time. And, you know, there is always holding out hope. There always is, there always was, and without that closure, she was always going to hold on to it. And it's kind of, for her, this is a huge thing. And I don't, it was just a really difficult episode to watch, just from the perspective of realizing what this actually means for her. And, you know, we may talk about the potential of a Jay and Caitlin romance and the chemistry between the two, but, you know, there was always that hanging over her through the entirety of the first few episodes of this season. And I guess this is a way for her to kind of put a lid on things, to realize, hey, this is it. I have to move on. Like, this is how it is from now on. And yeah, it was just a really hard episode, especially for anyone who's dealt with loss before and grief. Like, it was just really interesting to see her reactions through the entire episode. You almost got the every single stage of grief as you kind of went through this episode from start to finish.
Yeah, she kind of was in denial when we first saw her, because she completely left Star Labs and was working at Tina McGee's lab for those 6 months. Mm-hmm. So she was kind of avoiding everything so she didn't have to deal with it. And then she's sort of forced to deal with it in a very short period of time because of the way his conditioning is worsening so quickly. So it's forcing her to face these emotions she'd been avoiding for so long. And that's rough.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it was very well done, well acted as well. Again, every single show that was on this week had amazing acting throughout. Like, I'm continuously impressed with how all of these shows are, like, upping their game every single week.
Yeah, super great. So they eventually bring Jax into the fold. Caitlin goes to apologize, and they're attacked by Hewitt, who has turned into a big metahuman fiery monster, and he's pissed off about not getting to be Firestorm, so he's attacking. So they head to Star Labs, and Jax sees how Stein's conditioning is worsening, and he agrees, and the fusion works. And so they have to go stop Hewitt, who is attacking the football field where Jax used to play football, and where he ended his playing career when the particle accelerator explosion, and they successfully defeat him between Firestorm and the Flash. They managed to work together to make him so angry that he essentially blew his top and blew all his power, and that kind of ended it for him. So got the new superhero team in town.
Yeah, and I really liked Jax. I like that he was a little bit unsure about whether or not he wanted the responsibility of becoming a superhero, and to have that power and to have that kind of resting on his shoulders. But then seeing him turn around when he realized the implications of him not stepping up and even trying, what that could mean, you know, I think it was a great test of character to see him faced with Dr. Stein and his condition becoming less stable, and basically making the decision to accept that responsibility to save another person's life. Like, that was a really great moment, and I kind of was like, oh, I think I'm gonna like this character quite a lot.
And it was convenient that Hewitt went to the football field, but it made it so it was kind of full circle, and Jax got to go to the place where everything went south for him, and his new beginning essentially started where everything ended before. So it was nice full circle for him.
Yeah, it was narratively, it was a very beautiful moment. It was almost a rebirth in the place where he believes his future died. Like, and it's giving him that hope again for a better future. And the idea of him being able to be able to do good in a different way. Like, it just, yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed this whole, like, storyline with creating the new Firestorm. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of Jax.
Same. I remember when they cast him and they were just saying, he's playing Mystery Hero. And we're all like, who's Mystery Hero? And they were telling us everything else about all the other characters they were bringing into Legends of Tomorrow. And then there was Jax, who was mystery hero. And now it makes total sense why they didn't want to say anything, because they would be spoiling that Ronnie died.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was kind of the A plot of the episode. And I guess we both agree that we like Jax and are looking forward to seeing more of him.
Yeah. Bring it so, on.
Yeah. So kind of the B plot of this episode was Iris and her mother. Iris agrees to meet her mother, but she isn't really having any of it. She essentially tells her mother that she doesn't want to have a relationship with her, which, understandable, because she disappeared and was gone for 20 years. So I kind of don't blame Iris for being pissed off.
Yeah, and I mean, it could have even been, like, at that point, she's like, look, I don't want you in my life and whatever, but, you know, they could have gotten to the point where they could reconcile eventually. But, you know, at that point, it's kind of like, you know, if you didn't have the decency to even, like, explain why you were gone, even if you weren't around all of the time, keeping some kind of contact, any kind of contact, in 20 years, you know, that's a huge thing for her not to grow up with her mother, to believe that she was, to be, have to be led to believe that her mother was dead because, you know, she had things that were, in her eyes, more important, i.e. the drugs. And then when it kind of got to the point where she had to go through rehab in order to, you know, get through it to keep Iris safe, you know, she ran away. She abandoned her family. And yeah, okay, maybe telling Iris that her mother was dead wasn't, you know, the best thing that Joe could have done, but it kind of allowed Iris to grow up without this feeling of abandonment hovering over her. And I don't know, it just, it was interesting to then see her, like, take charge and be like, actually, you know what? I'm okay how I am. You weren't in my life for the first 20 years. I don't need you in it right now either. I can be me without you, and I don't need that relationship in my life.
And I appreciated that Joe refused to take any sides on it.
Yeah.
He's just like, your mother wants this opportunity. I will set it up if you want, and I will not push you either way. So he never wants her to go one side or the other. He's never like, you should have a relationship or don't. And I think that's really great that he's just, I will back you up whatever you want to do. I think that that shows that their relationship is healthier than it was when he was lying to her about Barry.
Yeah, definitely. I just like their relationship in general. I think, you know, he brought Iris up in the best way that he could. And the fact that Iris is this strong, amazing, confident woman who is successful, but she's also not afraid to be emotional and to kind of feel things really, really deeply. But, you know, she's completely in charge of her own life, her own emotions, and so on. And it just, it's a testament to them both, like how they affect each other, that, you know, they know each other so deeply and so intimately. And it's just a great relationship to see on screen. Like, that kind of closeness, it's really nice. Especially because sometimes, you know, the single parent narrative can sometimes go one way or the other. It can either be done really, really well, or sometimes you can be like, what the hell are you doing? What's going on?
Yeah, I wrote an article last season about how Joe was kind of problematic as a father to Iris because of the ways he was keeping secrets and kind of trying to decide what was best for her. But I think he has grown out of that, essentially. He's realized and understood that, you know, my daughter is an adult. She can make her own choices. And it shows that their relationship is much healthier as a result of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so kind of we find out that Francine has come back because she is dying. She has McGregor's, which is what William Tockman had when he was on Arrow and The Flash. So she has maybe until the end of the year. to live. And that's why she has come back. She wants Iris to know her, and she says to miss her, which is kind of selfish.
I was thinking that as well. I was like, that's an incredibly selfish thing to do to a daughter that you haven't been concerned about until it kind of means something to you. Like, until it affects you directly. Like, why would you do that to someone? Come into their life just so that they can be devastated by you actually permanently leaving this time. Like, that's horrible.
But yeah, so Iris ends up meeting with her mother again after Joe has told her the truth and is like, you know, I double checked, made sure you actually were sick and you weren't lying, and I was gonna be okay with you and be okay with having a relationship. But then, using her amazing investigative reporter skills, she discovered that her mother had a baby 8 months after leaving Central City. And as we all know, it takes 9 months to go through pregnancy. So she was a month pregnant when she left, which is probably about the time she found out. So there's a couple possibilities there. Iris jumps to the conclusion that she has a brother and that Joe is the father. But my thought is that she was probably having an affair of some kind, maybe with the dealer or something. And because why else would she run and stay gone for 20 years?
Yeah, I don't understand the motivation there either. Like, if it was her son with Joe, why wouldn't she have stayed there for Joe to help bring the child up? Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense unless it wasn't his. And she was, I guess, worried about what would happen. Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, But either way, brother or half-brother.
This is clearly going to be Wally. So
oh, yeah.
How they're introducing Wally, who is Iris's nephew in the comics, but now he's going to be a sibling or half-sibling. So we know he's been cast, so we will be seeing him at some point. But they said that they were going to tweak his origins for the show, and they definitely have.
Yeah, and I kind of like that it's something like a brother or a half brother. Like, I think it'll be interesting to see how easily he transitions into the family, because obviously he's going to end up, especially if his mother is dying, and I guess we're assuming here that she also remained in his life and brought him up. And yeah. He isn't off somewhere completely different as well. You know, on the assumption that he will end up coming into town. It'll be interesting to see how Joe and Iris react to him, how well he fits into the family, everything that'll go on there. Like, I'm looking forward to seeing all of this West family drama kick off.
And then Barry figures into that because he was essentially adopted by the Wests when he was younger. So how then Barry reacts to that, too.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. So I'm looking forward to actually meeting him and seeing how he's portrayed in this series.
Yeah, me too.
All right. So that kind of covers that plot point. The small, kind of a small side plot that kind of comes to a head at the end of the episode is that Harrison Wells from Earth 2 is being creepy, sketchy, sneaking around Star Labs, and then he ends up at Dr. Tina McGee's lab and steals some kind of weapon, and she sees him and is like, whoa, maybe he's alive after all. So she freaks out. So he's wandering around, and when Barry gets attacked by the giant shark man at the end of the episode, which is like my favorite thing ever, the only thing that stops it is a blast from the weapon that Harrison Wells stole, and Barry catches up with him and sees that it's Wells, and dun dun dun.
Yeah, I was like, oh, not able to get my head around the Wells thing because shark. That was one way to end the episode, seriously.
My god, it's my favorite thing that they've ever done, I think.
Yeah, man, I just sorry. Oh, I was looking forward to just getting to this bit because I can't get over, like, the... this show edges between completely absurd and ridiculous, and then it gets, like, really hard-hitting, emotional, deeply intimate moments. And there's kind of no in-between. It literally pendulums from one to the other in the same episode.
Yeah, and it was kind of the string through the episode of Patty thinks that there's a shark man, and Bear is like, really? A shark man? I'll go along with it and run your tests, but, you know, not so much, because really, a shark man, even the people on this show have their limits, and shark man is past that. And then he turns out to be real. It was the best reveal.
Oh. Seriously, just when you think they couldn't do anything like more ridiculous, they introduce sharks. Like, brilliant, absolutely brilliant, because they honestly make you believe that she's being ridiculous, that she's seeing things that she's like, I don't know, and then it turns out to be true, and you're like, ha! I just, were you just like staring at the screen when that happened, and you're just like, really?
I think I made like a really high-pitched squeal and then flailed, like, it's real, it's real, it's real! Like, I was just so pleased that they went there. Oh, so good. I loved it. I loved it. But yeah, so Harrison is super sketchy.
Yeah, but he always is.
So the Harrison before he was murdered by Ava Barthon didn't seem like he was super sketchy. Like, in the flashbacks that we got of him, he seemed like he was decent enough.
Oh, then, God, there's no knowing. There's no knowing if he's a good guy, a bad guy, if everything's like, if he's an in-the-middle kind of guy. Like, it's... Because obviously when we were introduced to him last season, he was technically someone else just wearing that face. It's always going to be difficult to know whether or not what he's doing is a genuine reaction to like keeping Barry and the rest of them safe, or whether he has ulterior motives. And we've already got that suspicion ingrained in us because of the entire first season, and they're playing it up really, really well.
Yeah, and he's not helping with the way he's, like, skulking around. And so it'll be interesting to see what he's up to, why he's in this world, why he made the effort to come, and all of that. So what do you want, Harrison Wells? And then I guess the last final thing with this episode was just Joe was encouraging Barry to go after Patty because they have obvious chemistry, and Joe could tell that Barry really likes her, and she obviously really likes Barry. So he's like, you should totally do it.
Okay. Wow. you should totally do it. Like,
you should hit that.
Bow chicka wow wow.
I liked when he was like, what's with you and Iris and my partners? Like,
yeah. There's something in the water.
But yeah, I think Patty's adorable, and I really like her.
Yeah, me too. And I like how she works with Barry. Like, their personalities mesh really, really well. Like, it's really sweet just to see them interacting. And I think, like you said, I think it was either in the last episode or the episode before, it's at least better than his attempt at romance in the first season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Though, to my surprise, Linda has been popping up.
Yeah.
I didn't think we'd ever see her again.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, props for that, because she was ingrained, like, in Iris's job. And so they're actually going with that. So I was happy to see her again.
Yeah, same. It's kind of like in this show, if there are background characters who are kind of recurring and keep popping up, when, like, their purpose, I guess, in furthering, like, the main characters, or when they get tangled up in the main characters' stories, and then that purpose comes to an end, you still see them in the background, which is really quite nice, because it's kind of like, it helps build the world a little bit, to be like, even if they're not directly involved, in the main character's narrative, they are still part of this world, part of this city. They don't just disappear because they're not involved directly anymore. They still have lives, they still have purpose, just not in conjunction with what the main characters are currently doing. But that doesn't mean that they stop existing, which is quite cool. It's not something you see very often.
I mean, and it's probably more for financial reasons than anything, that they don't want to have to pay these actors when they're just going to be kind of with a couple of lines and then that's it. But I appreciate that they're apparently bringing Linda around a bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was The Fury of Firestorm. Any other thoughts?
No, no. We covered everything from New Firestorm to Sharks.
So good. And then there was the emotionally devastating Arrow Beyond Redemption.
Which was, funnily enough, actually a line in the episode.
I know.
It was one of those moments when the line was said, because I was like sitting, I only watched this episode today, because obviously being, can't watch it live, I like my sleep. But I was basically like watching it, and then when the line was said, I was like, oh, and there's your link to the episode title.
It's like, take a shot when the episode title gets dropped.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
I noticed that too. That's definitely there. So, yeah. So this episode was really a very Quentin Lance-centric episode, which I didn't know I needed it in my life, but I really liked it.
Yeah, I like Quentin Lance, and I guess I think even when some other people have had, I guess sometimes his character goes through fits and spurts of, like, sometimes people don't like him a lot because he acts a little holier than thou, and he kind of, through the first couple of seasons at least, is, like, really aggressive and kind of almost vindictive in certain ways, and kind of got a little preachy. And a lot of people didn't like him in the first season. I know Marima didn't like him, because I remember us talking about it previously when she was catching up with Arrow. But I really like the actor a lot. And I don't know if that's always coloured my my feelings about Quentin Lance specifically, because I've always really liked him. And it may be because he played Harry Dresden and, yeah. If you are not familiar with the Dresden Files, it is a huge love of mine, and he played my favorite character from those books in the very short-lived TV adaptation. And yeah, so I kind of have always had a bit of a fondness for the actor, and I think he's fantastic. So when this kind of started moving into being a very Quentin Lance-centric episode, I was like, yes, finally, my moment has come as a fan of this actor.
Yeah, so he had a couple of plots going in this episode. First, there's the whole deal with, they're dealing with crooked cops in this episode that are stealing drugs from dealers and then selling them back to other dealers for a profit, because the city has gone to crap and they have no job security or anything. So they're trying to make money and skip town. So Lance essentially accepts the help of Team Arrow, and he just wants to be involved in it because he kind of takes it as a personal affront that there are crooked cops. So he gets involved in that storyline. And then there's also the story where Laurel has learned her lesson about keeping secrets, especially about family from her father. So she tells him about Sarah. Laurel is keeping Sarah chained up in the basement of her apartment. How could that go wrong? And Laurel brings Quentin to see her, and it's about as heart-wrenching as you would expect it to be.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very, very devastating. Like, I kind of was like, oh god, this is just gonna be... it's just gonna be emotionally devastating from start to finish, because even from the promo for last week, like, when we got that for after the episode for this episode, and you're like, there, you see him leveling the gun at her, and you're like, oh my god, how heartbreaking must that be? He's not only lost his daughter twice before, and he's had to go through that grief twice, and at least the second time around, they had a body to bury, like, that time, but to have her brought back and to see her where she's not actually his daughter anymore, where she's completely unrecognizable, and that he's kind of resigned himself to the fact that he kind of has to put an end to that, because it's not fair to Sarah and Sarah's legacy, and it's also, you know, devastating to them, like, having to go through that and think, I'm gonna have to actually this time be the one that puts an end to this, like, that's horrifying, like, the what he must have had to go through emotionally to get himself to that point, like, oh, it just, I wanted to cry through this entire episode.
Yeah, it's rough. So the other issue is that the team discovers that Quentin is working with Damian Dark. They find some dashboard footage of him talking to Dark because he went to go ask him for advice about Sarah, because he knows that Dark was a member of the League of Assassins. So, and Dark essentially tells him that he should put her down because her soul is not in her anymore. Which is going to tie into what Donnie's really excited about next week.
Oh, God, so excited. Ah.
But we'll get there.
Yeah, we will. We will.
But a huge confrontation that has been four seasons incoming. Oliver is waiting in Lance's apartment and essentially just yells at him. And I put in this gif of Tyra Banks from Top Model of the "I was rooting for you, we were all rooting for you" gif, because that was pretty much what Oliver was saying to Lance. Like, you're supposed to be the better person here. Like, you are the one on the pedestal. You're the reason I'm running for mayor. So their dynamic has always been interesting to me, because Lance, despite his flaws, has always been kind of the morally upstanding character. He didn't like the vigilante because he was a murderer, so he was going after him. And he has continually pushed Oliver to be better, to do what he does and be better at it. And Oliver, for his part, really seems to, like, take Lance's opinion to heart. Like, he genuinely cares what he thinks. As much as he would like not to, he clearly does, because the fact that it was Lance's opinion that got him to decide to run for mayor shows all that. So, and then Oliver has also been tied up in all this tragedy in the Lance family. Like, he's the one who brought Sarah on the boat in the first place, and then he was cheating on Laurel doing it and all this stuff. It's very messy, and Oliver is tied up in all of it. So they have this very messy dynamic. And then, but through all of it, Quentin is supposed to be the morally upstanding character, and then for Oliver to kind of realize that he's actually human too, like, it really messes with him.
Yeah, yeah, it really, really does. Because, like you were saying, Oliver kind of looks to him to be almost his moral compass of sorts. Like, everything Lance has done and did for the city was always in the best interests of the people within that city. And knowing that he's just as susceptible to corruption and, I guess, doing things that kind of fall into a morally gray area in regard to who he's aligning himself with, at least, even if he isn't exactly doing the morally gray stuff himself, like, that's always going to shake your worldview. And whether he put Lance on that pedestal unnecessarily, like, if he didn't deserve to be held in that high regard, I mean, everyone's human, everyone's gonna make mistakes, but, you know, for Oliver to kind of see him in that way of being like, this is what I need to aim to be. I need to aim to be this better person. I need to do better for this city. I need to do better for the people around me who I love. I need to try and create stability for this city that is essentially falling to wreck and ruin. And this is the man who has always felt this and has always tried to do what he can to achieve this. And yeah, knowing that he's just as susceptible to fucking up, essentially, as Oliver is, like, that, you know, Oliver goes through a lot where he believes the best in people sometimes when they don't always deserve it. Like, yeah, he had a very narrow world view at one point, and obviously everything that happened with him on the island and the people he encountered and everything he went through after the boat went down, like, that really shook his world view up and how he viewed other people and how he himself actually treated everyone else as well. But, you know, when you have this presence in your life that's always this constant, and their views are so steadfast and their beliefs are steadfast that, you know, they're unwavering. And you kind of find out when you draw that back and you peel that back that maybe they're not the person that you thought they were. Like, yeah, it was interesting to see that all come to a head.
And I think Lance has always been kind of a beacon of hope for Oliver, that if there can be this one kind of morally upstanding guy who is fighting for the best of the city, then the city is still worth fighting for and we can save it. And that's always been Oliver's thing, is saving the city and seeing...
Take a shot.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. To become someone else. Shot. But, you know, Lance has always been kind of that beacon of hope that it was possible and that it was worth fighting for. And seeing even him going down that path of working with someone like Damian Dark makes him be like, maybe it's not worth fighting. That hope just is snuffed out, because if he can't stay morally upright in all of this, how can the city be worth fighting for? And I think that's just an interesting thing for him to have to work through and kind of figure it out on his own.
Yeah, and it's gonna be interesting over the next couple of episodes to see where that leads for Oliver, because obviously his campaign has started now. He is still, you know, thrown his hat into the ring to become mayor. So it's gonna be quite interesting, obviously, now that this has all come to a head and he's got to rebuild that hope and that belief kind of on his own. Like, he's gotta find his belief for himself. Like, he can't base it on someone else. He can't hold them accountable for being like the sole responsibility, almost, for shouldering this beacon of hope. He has to now become that, and kind of it's going to propel him in a really interesting direction, because it's kind of what they started setting up in the first episode back of this season when he makes that speech on TV when they broadcast that out, that, you know, he's going to become the hero that this city deserves. He's going to become the hero that he should have always been. You know, he is the Green Arrow. And seeing how that's going to also impact his day-to-day life when he's not wearing a mask, like, that's going to be really interesting to see play out.
Agreed. So yeah, the way that Quentin's going to make up for all of this, because Oliver hears him make a speech about redemption, not being beyond redemption. There's your title drop. But so he asks later if Quentin actually believes that. And Quentin's like, I'm going to turn myself in. And Oliver asks him not to. And he wants him to go undercover with Damian Dark. And that just solidified my belief that Quentin is the one in the grave, because that never ends well.
No.
Going undercover in an evil organization. And it runs parallel to what Oliver's doing in the flashbacks. And I don't think either of those is going to end particularly well.
No. Not especially. And I mean, I think you, after this episode, I think you might be onto something with where they're going to end up with the grave. But, you know, again, we're looking for things in regard to that. when the writers have said and keep continuing to say that they still don't know who's in the grave. So...
But narratively, it would make sense.
It would.
For him to be the one.
It would. But again, then how can they be dropping clues for something that they don't know that they're aiming for?
Haha, aiming for.
Oh, God. I made an unintentional pun. Hey, look at me go. It's almost like it's completely ingrained into my personality to make arrow-based puns. Blame Hawkeye.
But we also got to see the new Arrow Cave, and I really liked the touch that they bought the old Sebastian Blood headquarters because he had a lair of his own. Because he was doing all those Mirakuru experiments in season two. So they bought that up and re-outfitted it, and oh my god, it looks so good.
Eat your heart out, Batman.
Seriously.
It's like, you can have your damp, dark caves with all of those bats flying around, but Team Arrow is where it's at.
Yeah, so it looks pretty phenomenal. And guess who helped? Sisko! So
Sisko's just like, he's the designer.
Yeah, I said in my recap that, like, Sisko should start a design shop for superheroes.
Yeah.
Because he designs all their costumes, and now he designs their hideouts. So, always Sisko.
I think it's great. That's going to be his superhero name, The Designer.
It's true.
It is true.
But there's been some, like, lights going on and off and everything in the Arrow Cave. And gee, I wonder what's going on there. By which I mean, I think it's Rey.
Yeah.
Just to throw that out there.
Yeah. And when you're proved right, again. Because you already figured out the Star City thing. So, you know, you kind of, you've got your eye on the ball here. You kind of, you're very, very good at figuring
Bullseye.
Out whether... Oh, so many puns.
But continuing on, there's Sarah. She doesn't have a lot to do, but she speaks for the first time in this episode.
Yes.
She says, "Who am I?" which was sad.
Yeah.
And then she choked Laurel, which was kind of scary.
Yeah.
But the episode pretty much ends with Laurel coming down to bring Sarah food, and Sarah's gone.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably see that coming. Trying to keep your feral sister in the basement is never gonna end well.
Your feral League of Assassins trained sister.
Yeah, who may or may not currently have the soul of your sister inside her body. Right now.
Are we talking about an episode of Supernatural right now?
You know, it could be. I mean,
because they did the whole soulless thing, so yeah. Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that's gonna come to a head in the next episode.
Yes, it is.
Which Danya is very excited about.
Yes, I am. Oh, man. Can I just say the promo for the next episode literally gave me chills. I was freaking out. And the second Constantine spoke, I was just making, like, gibberish sounds. Like, they weren't actual words. It was kind of like...
Surprising nobody.
No, not even a little bit. I'm so glad he's back. I'm so, so happy to see him. And all of the stills and all of the everything for the next episode, I was freaking out. Though I don't know what he's doing with that feather, but, you know, whatever, it's Constantine. He does weird stuff all the time. It doesn't need to make sense. He's just a weirdo. Oh.
Yeah, so he'll be coming in to save Sarah, basically.
To get her soul back.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, so we're in for a dramatic episode next week.
Yes, it looks rough. I have my theories based on the stills, so we'll see. We'll see if I'm right about those.
Well, go on then.
Well, we see Thea in the hospital, and I think Sarah probably attacks her, which is what pushes Oliver to call Constantine. But because Malcolm told Thea that the only way to sate the bloodlust of the Lazarus Pit is to kill the person who hurt you, and Thea technically is the one who killed Sarah. Mm. So, you know, the gray areas of that dynamic wouldn't matter to Sarah and her current situation. But
yes.
So Thea, her last memory would be of Thea shooting her, basically. So I have a feeling that she's going after Thea because Thea was the one who killed her. And then that's what pushes Oliver to call Constantine.
Oh, that would be so good. I mean, not good in the sense of, like, Sarah trying to kill Thea, but good in the sense of, like, that coming full circle and having consequences. Obviously, neither of them being fully responsible for their actions right now, and them trying to right that. And obviously now that Thea is kind of more in charge of herself and is basically telling Malcolm where to shove it, it'll be nice to see them bring Sarah back to herself as well and give her agency back, and her then going back to kicking ass and being the Sarah that we love.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, both Thea and Sarah will be, like, cured of their bloodlust if they take out Malcolm, because he was the one behind both of them. Like, his actions caused both of their deaths / almost death, so I think they both need to work together and, like, shove him off a cliff.
Road trip side plot.
Yeah. And then they can bring Laurel and free Nyssa and have her help, and they can all just, like, each put a boot to his chest and, like, knock him over that massive cliff.
And then Nyssa can become the head of the League of Assassins.
Yeah.
Like I wanted.
And she can marry Sarah and everything will be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think killing Malcolm is kind of where they need to go with this. And I'm not just saying that because I hate Malcolm, but he literally is at the core of everything that hurt both of these characters.
And you kind of think, how does the Lazarus Pit judge the blame in regard to who is responsible for that death? Because Thea wasn't necessarily in her right mind at the time. So, I mean, it's this kind of awkward, mystic, kind of spiritual middle ground that hasn't been explored much on Arrow. Like, is it very black and white, as in it is the physical action that is responsible, or is it the kind of responsibility behind it? You know, would the Lazarus Pit see Thea as she was used, which was as a weapon to achieve an end for Malcolm? Like, where does that lie? Like, how does it judge that sort of thing? You know, it's very hard to know how it kind of views the blame in regard to who is actually responsible for that death.
Yeah. So I don't know if they'll even go there, but that's sort of my thought on it. But we shall see.
Yes, we shall.
And you can just be, like, really excited for the next several days till the next episode airs.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry. I'm going to be. I've already gotten, like, overexcited puppy today because Daniel Cerone has already been tweeting that to boost Arrow, like, he said if one of his tweets got 2K retweets, he's going to be posting the script for what would have been episode 14 of Constantine. And as of right now, it's got 2,310 retweets, so looks like that's going to be coming. And I'm freaking out because I'm going to get the script for what could have been episode 14. I'm going to be really sad because we're not going to get episode 14, but at least I can kind of know what it might have been.
Well, that ties into your quote of the week.
It does, but we do need to go through some movie news first. So, on the movie side of things, much like TV, we haven't got much. On the Marvel side of things, Matthew McConaughey passed on the lead villain role in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which, you know, I'm not entirely surprised at that. Matthew McConaughey kind of picks a lot of really strongly scripted projects. And while Marvel movies may be fun and may be great and may be fantastic, and, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy was a good movie, their villains, not so much. So the fact that he's passed on the villain role kind of makes me worried that it's not a particularly well-written role again. I don't know why Marvel just can't get their villains right.
Yeah, they're more devices than characters, so yeah. It's not surprising that an Academy Award-winning actor wouldn't want to play a character that's just a device.
Yeah, but hey, what are you gonna do? Obviously, so they're still looking for the actor who's gonna be playing the villain in Guardians of the Galaxy 2. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of, yeah, it's just one of those things. And, yeah, he did say something a little bit earlier this year about Marvel movies, but he was like, I've read some Marvel and DC scripts, and I've talked about working with them on some scripts. Nothing has been right for me yet, but I'm sure open to it. It's very simple for me. I look at the script, it starts with the story and the character. So, again, that kind of lends into the thought that, again, it's not a good enough character. But they have added a female character to the movie as well.
Shocking.
Actually, yeah, but it's not just a female character. It's a female actress of color. She's an Asian actress. So it's Pom Clemente, who will be playing a key role in the film. But that's all that we know so far. We don't know exactly who she's going to be playing. But it's probably going to be one of those things, again, where I don't know if this bothers anyone else slightly as well, but when they finally cast a major character of color in a major role in a movie on the female side, they then covered her up in green paint. You know, so I'm kind of not really expecting her to actually be a human character or a humanoid character where we'll actually see her race. I think it'll probably be either a CGI character or it'll be covered up in terms of probably paint again.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, so who knows? But hey, I guess at the very least we're getting a character of color or a person of color playing a role, which, you know. The other thing we've got, though there are still really conflicting reports about this. So, Captain America Civil War trailer. It is currently being reported that it's going to debut with Star Wars The Force Awakens. So that makes sense. You know, Collider are the ones reporting on this. They have said that a source has told them that it's basically going to be in front of Star Wars, which, considering Disney owns both Marvel and Lucasfilm, that would make a lot of sense. However, there is still rumors going around that the trailer is going to be attached to Spectre, the new James Bond movie, which doesn't make a lot of sense, particularly in Russia. So it's kind of, there's conflicting reports floating around right now, but if I was going to put my weight behind one of the rumors, I would say it's going to debut with Star Wars, just because why would Disney allow the trailer for their highest anticipated movie of next year go in front of a movie that they have no role over, they have no links to, they have no attachment to?
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. I would totally buy that.
Yeah. And that's it from the Marvel side of things.
And on the DC side, we continue to get pictures from Suicide Squad, and that may be positive or negative, depending on your view. We got another look at Jared Leto's Joker, which continued that alligator pimp look that he had going on in the last picture. And he continues to look terrible. Just, I can't.
Yeah.
He looks awful.
I'm not, no. We talked about this in the last episode. Definitely not digging this look. It is not improving with any new image that we get. Sorry.
No. It just, it looks terrible. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. And then the other image that we got was of Enchantress, who is very scantily clad in this cover in some sort of like metal bikini, because apparently we're going Star Wars on this.
Yeah, I think I saw some extra information floating around that she is going to be basically coming back from like stasis. So she's gonna have been kind of like asleep for like hundreds of thousands of years kind of thing. So she is like an ancient, like a really ancient force kind of thing who's like come back, and she's mightily pissed off. So that's going to be quite interesting. And it does, from the image, look as though she's dug herself up out of the earth. So personally, that grungy look with all the dirt all over her.
Yeah, and she did it in her metal bikini.
Yeah, I guess it would, look, I get the, from a standpoint of it's very sexualized, it's leaving nothing to the imagination, but I would be interested in finding out if, like, what time period she's from. Like, because I can't remember where I read it. I think it was the Mary Sue, actually, where they were talking about the costume and the character and some of the character details. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of, I'm oddly interested in this look, despite it being so scantily clad. Like, I'm kind of intrigued where they're going with her. Whereas with the Joker, I'm just like, go away.
Yeah. I feel like the more pictures I see of a lot of things, the less interested I get, which is too bad because I was really into the trailer.
I mean, with the Enchantress, like, it kind of depends on how they depict this. If they sexualize it on screen, if they make it a spectacle, if they make her a sexual object, then that's when this costume, this bikini, this metal bikini becomes problematic. If they make her an object of sexual attention. But if they treat it in an interesting way, if the costume is kind of, if she's the one in control of that, if this is her choice, her agency choosing to be dressed like that, if this is, you know, if it has a very strong, valid kind of point in the storyline and it's not sexualized, then, you know, it all depends on the treatment of the costume, how it's taken. Like, I don't know.
I'm not optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping. I will keep...
You're always more optimistic than I am.
I know. I want to believe the best in a lot of things, but this is probably why I end up disappointed more. Right, let's move on to our quotes of the week, because that is literally it for movie headlines. So, do you want to go with yours?
Sure, so mine goes back to our favorite moment with King Shark, and when Patty sees him attacking the Flash, she draws her gun and says, "Put him down, put your fins in the air," just like the correction, your fins, like, yeah. Oh, cracked me up. I love her so much.
Yeah, I thought it was really great. Mine is from the promo for next week's episode of Arrow, when they're basically talking about, very briefly, how to, like, help Sarah get her soul back. And Diggle is like, "What if something goes wrong?" And Constantine, like, basically replies with, "Then we'll all be too dead to care. On with the show." It's just that fuck it all attitude that I just love about him. So it was just a great, beautiful moment. I'm so looking forward to having him back. Finally.
For one episode.
Stop saying that.
I'm trying to temper your expectations because I know you'll be disappointed.
I know. But speaking of Constantine, it's time for Comic Corner, and he is the focus of this week. So I've put together my top five trades for Constantine, basically to get you ready for next week and to get you as excited as I am. So the first one I've got is Original Sins. So this is the best introduction you could have to Constantine. Original Sins kicks things off with a bang. It offers a brutally honest look at 1980s British culture through a man gambling with his own life and isn't afraid of that. Though Constantine's trademark trench coat doesn't feature much in this trade, you get a firm handle on just who John really is, as it tackles some heavy social issues, including racism and the AIDS epidemic. This trade also introduces one of Constantine's recurring adversaries, and sometimes ally, Papa Midnight. Next one I've got is Haunted. So, Haunted finds Constantine coming up against a merciless dark magician called Joshua Wright after he murders one of John's ex-girlfriends. This book is not for the faint-stomached, as her murder is recounted in gruesome detail. Constantine exacts his revenge on Wright in an equally gruesome way, and it reminds him that sentiment and romance was never made for people like him, as anyone who gets close to John dies in horrible, unjust, and painful ways. And it's a gut wrench to remember that he's condemned himself to a life of solitude as he navigates between our world and the world of demons. Next one I've got is Hold Me. So this one shot by Neil Gaiman serves as a fleeting love letter to Constantine's humanity. It expertly weaves the horror story elements of Constantine's origins with a stunning character study of a man who is without hope. It also serves as a commentary on the realities of our relationships, romantic and otherwise, and hits home some hard truths on society's indifference to the homeless. Though John comes out of this trade mostly unscathed, offering a small moment of triumph, it only serves to highlight the tragedy of John's situation all the more. Next one I've got is Ashes and Dust in the City of Angels. This is often a controversial story amongst Constantine fans. It follows a detective as he tries to piece together the events leading up to Constantine's death. It deconstructs John through his relationship with others, particularly Stanley Manor, his murderer. It highlights painfully the thin line between love and hate, and when it debuted back in the early 2000s, proved that Hellblazer could still surprise audiences after a decade of material. We won't spoil the shocker here, but it's definitely worth the read, even though Constantine himself isn't on the page for more than a few panels per issue. And finally, I've got Dangerous Habits, which is probably Hellblazer's most critically acclaimed run. So Dangerous Habits is a must-read for anyone interested in Constantine as a character. John's smoking habit catches up with him as he's diagnosed with lung cancer, and everything in his life spirals out of control in a beautifully relatable way. Up until this point, John had been living life as a seemingly immortal man. As he faces his own mortality and his bleak legacy, he eventually makes a deal that will change him irrevocably forever. Beautifully written and completely devastating in parts, it's certainly not a story you want to miss out on. And that's it. Let's move into some feedback, because we do have a little bit. First thing we've got, Matthew contacted us on Twitter and said, "Can I just say how heartbreaking Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was this week, and that I loved how much of a BAMF Simmons is." Yeah, pretty much agreed, Matthew.
I think Simmons surprised herself at how much of a badass she was.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
All right, so we got a comment on Hypeable from Stephanie M., who said, "I was pretty solid in my theory that the person in the grave would be the mother of Oliver's secret kid. He didn't look upset enough for it to be Felicity or even Dig, Thea, or Laurel, and since Barry wasn't that upset either, possibly someone he's never met. I kind of liked the idea of Oliver finding out about having to raise his son in season 5, plus stepmom Felicity would be adorable flail. But now since the writers have admitted they have no clue who it is, they've totally ruined the fun of speculating. Plus, it puts an odd, which fan theory will the writers choose sort of spin on the whole thing, and we all know how well that's worked out on other shows, cough, heroes, cough. I guess all I can say is, arrow voice, Greg and Mark, you have failed this plot arc."
Oh, I love this. You have failed this blank is now, like, it's a thing. This is becoming a thing. Everyone should get involved. Yeah, I don't disagree with this. I think everyone's going to have their theories about who's in the grave, but like we've been saying, it's kind of stupid to speculate at this point because everyone probably has as much chance of being right about it as anyone else because the writers haven't decided yet. So, yeah, I don't necessarily disagree that it kind of takes the fun out of speculating because at the moment, even though there's this end point in sight, no one, including the people running the entire show, knows what that end point specifically is. So,
and I wonder at what point, excuse me, they'll know and whether they'll say anything about it, because when can we really start thinking about who it actually is?
Yeah. Why do they do this to us? We got another comment on Hyperbole as well. This one was from Cassie, who says, "Felicity Smoke, you have failed this omelette," is pretty much my favorite line ever. I'm still giggling over it. I want full name, "You have failed this noun," to be a new thing, like in real life. Sadly, none of my friends watch Arrow, so they have no idea what I'm talking about and just look at me strangely whenever I try that line on them. Will you lovely ladies be my new friends? Haha. I'm so happy to be getting more episodes and more Marvel movies. I'm willing to bet that one of the mystery movies is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. And Cassie also gave a Comic Corner request. Alpha Flight, please? Pretty please? All I know about them is that they're a team of Canadian mutants. Yeah, national pride, but I can't really find many publications or other information on them. Cassie, Alpha Flight is on the list. I will do my best to get you some recommendations. And of course we'll be your friends. Duh.
Obviously.
Yeah, come and make horrible puns at us on Twitter, and if you see anyone being stupid, Donald Trump, you have failed this planet. There we go, I've got you started. Go, you give one to us. There we go, that's your first one. Right, that's it for feedback. Let's move into question of the week. So we have let you for the last couple of episodes carrying on with answering the what powers would you want if you were an Inhuman question, because obviously we released so many episodes in a row, we wanted to give you enough time to answer that. We're changing the question this week because there's going to be a whole week without episodes now before you get to the next one. So,
oh my gosh.
I know. That's going to be a novel experience from a recording standpoint. But we did get one more answer for it. So Shelby said, "I'd want to have telekinesis mostly because I could get something far away without getting up." Shelby, I like the way you think.
I need the remote.
Yeah.
Basically. Eat my popcorn.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, yeah. I can get on board with that idea for a power. God, we would all be the laziest superheroes ever.
It's true.
It's so true. We'd either be using our powers to, like, make our lives slightly more convenient, or definitely using our powers to make our lives more convenient. Oh, dear. Do you want to ask the new question of the week, Caitlin?
I would love to. So in honor of Oliver Queen's mayoral candidacy kicking off this week, we are asking you, what would your campaign slogan be? And remember to hit us up on Twitter at Hero Hype Podcast to let us know.
Yeah. And that's it. So we will be coming back at you in a week's time once, you know, all the rest of these episodes have come out. So until next time, guys, I'm Danya.
And I'm Caitlin.
And we'll see you next week. Bye, guys.
Bye.